Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 15th of December. We're going to be talking about university educations all over the world this hour of the program. Our attention brought to this topic because of the demonstrations that took place in England, where thousands of students were marching in the streets because the cost of tuition was probably going to go up to £9,000, which I had my husband figure this out for me because I didn't have an internet last night, which is about $14,500. The government said in England that the reforms were fair and affordable for the nation. Those who were marching in the streets felt differently about this, but it got us thinking about higher education. When you are in an economic downturn, a worldwide economic downturn, how many countries have said, we simply can't deal with this. We can't keep universities open unless you pay more for them. There are other countries that have done all they can because they really think that they need to retrain workers and they need to train lots and lots of workers to keep their economies flourishing. So it's a problem. And then, of course, we were wondering what's happening in the United States as well. Well, we have just the perfect guest who's looked not only at the United States, but he's looked at what's going on with universities all over the world. He's looked at Asia. He's looked at many European countries and knows what's going on here, too. He is John Aubrey Douglas from the Center for Studies in Higher Education at UC Berkeley. And he is with us this next hour on the Ideas Network. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-865. Oh, no, it's not. It's 800-642. Thank you, Rhonda. 1234. It's the second time I've done that. I'm just a creature of habit. 800-642-1234. We're in Madison today. John is Senior Research Fellow and at the Center for Studies in Higher Education, and his interests are focused on the student experience in research universities, the role of universities in economic development, science policy as a component of national and multinational economic policy. He has served as deputy director of the center, and he is the author of lots of publications and books, including one that most recently looked at what's going on with education and tuition and help from governments for universities all over the world. And we're happy to have him with us. Professor Aubrey Douglas, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. It's a treat to be on your show.
Well, it's a treat to have you. You know, you're just the perfect guest. We were talking about this in terms of, you know, framing the issue, and then we found you. And you're the perfect guest because you know the answer to all of these questions. I think it's really interesting what countries around the world have done during an economic downturn to deal with public education. We may want to start in England because it's foremost in our minds with the demonstrations that took place with students in the streets and with a decision to increase tuition. You want to start there? Why did the government decide that had to be done, and how is it a departure from funding education in England?
Well, you know, this lines up with the arrival of the Conservatives and David Cameron as Prime Minister in England. So I did, just a background, I did a kind of a paper on what's going on globally with higher ed budgets and how are states, you know, thinking about their higher ed systems in light of the Great Recession. And, I did this kind of a survey about a year ago and wrote a paper about that. And at that time, of course, it was before the general, you know, election, and Gordon Brown was still prime minister. But even then, there had been a delay in cuts, but there was anticipation of quite significant financial cuts to the higher ed sector, again, because of, England has a certain kind of makeup of its deficit that is very similar to many ways with the U.S. housing bubble, large debt, national debt, and personal debt, that kind of thing. So at that time, there were already plans for large cuts, something like in the range of £600 million were going to be cut out of the system. As to how that was going to be handled, it was not clear. The English like to make big plans and then not really think about necessarily all the implications. That's my opinion. But there's a kind of a culture of how they approach political problems. Then this is all escalated hugely with the arrival of David Cameron and the Tories, and this is a coalition government. So with the Liberal Democrats, there's a complication related to that. But basically, you know, this is a slash-and-burn approach to the deficit problems that are facing England, which are very substantial, absolutely. But in my view, it's an overreach. This isn't a pick-and-choose winners and losers, and how can we figure out which parts of the economy do we really need to sustain in order to, you know, build long-term economic development. I would say education is one of those areas. They've just done across-the-board cut. So they've announced, and it's been recently approved by Parliament, a 40% cut across the board of all government agencies. And that's...
Wow.
Yeah, it's a startling number. That's over a three-year period. Exactly how that's all going to be done is not quite clear. This is all in reaction to the concept that stimulus activity, this Keynesian approach, is now we're not doing that. We're going to focus on the deficit problems and, you know, the fear of the costs that relate to deficits and how it can, you know, affect, you know, your monetary supply and what you can buy and all that kind of thing. And so there were only a few minor exceptions. Healthcare was one of them. But this is 40% across the board, including defense. So higher education isn't like picked as one piece of, you know, an exception or how are we going to do this. They basically just made this large number, and then they tried to figure out, well, how are they going to, you know, keep the system going? There are around 110 research universities in England, and then there's something called a further education sector, which is a little bit like our community colleges, but not really. That the focus is on these research universities, and a previous report had been pushing, and there's a group of the elite institutions that have been pushing for greater tuition flexibility. There's been a national cap on tuition. It started at £3,000 when it was introduced in 1997 under Tony Blair and the Labour government. This kind of a neoliberal approach to government that also characterized Clinton here in the United States. This is where this shift has come. They've said, well, you know, in order to make the system function somehow financially, we're going to raise the cap to £9,000, as you just mentioned, which is around $14,000. You have to realize, again, an American perception often is, you know, we think of, well, what do we pay now? And if something goes up, that's your kind of base of how you think of these things. Well, So $14,000 for something that many in England think should be a free, you know, public good item, and it was before 1997, see these increases as, you know, they're quite dramatic. And so this is why you're seeing the students rioting. And, in fact, there was this incident with the Prince of Wales getting his car.
Right, getting
and
pummeled.
All of that. So, and, you know, what I would say is, almost even in minor changes, you will often see a certain kind of student movement protest about fee increases. But this is, you know, this is a bit more exaggerated and larger. So this is a really large increase. And one of the big questions, this is one last point, is that you're seeing a kind of certain groups of the higher education system in England see this is something that is inevitable, and they want it, but they know they can charge the full rate. And I should have said that it's up to £9,000. So the concept is other institutions can pick what they think is the appropriate pricing that they think they can get, or will, you know, financially make them operate. But there's a grouping called the Russell Group, and this is about I think it's 20 universities led by Oxford, Cambridge, Imperial, you know, the certain grouping of the most elite institutions that have long pushed for this ability to charge more and to basically wean themselves off of or lower the amount of money they're getting.
Interesting. Well, take this from a world perspective. There are so many countries, I guess Asia is not on the list necessarily. They're suffering, but not as badly as England has been, the United States and Greece and more European countries. I think most people would say that it's a given that your chances of getting a good job are better if you have a college degree, and that there are a number of people who have lost their jobs who need to be retrained. So the universities are as important as they ever were, perhaps even more important right now. Is there a way, though, considering the fact that governments all over the world are hard-pressed for funds, to make sure that universities fulfill that mission even though there isn't as much money?
Yeah, well, you know, again, you have to realize there really are different situations in different parts of the world and different perceptions of the role of higher education.
Right.
So if you look at the grouping of of nations out there, and I don't pretend I know exactly what's going on everywhere, but I have a kind of a feel for it, you'll see different patterns. So those nations that have the most severe problems under the Great Recession, the U.S., Portugal, Ireland, Greece, Spain sits on the side. These countries have different kind of reactions in terms of their budgets and higher education. All share in some form this understanding that, in fact, higher education is a key component for future economic development and socioeconomic mobility. And the economic argument tends to be the one that we hear the most about. But there's an underlying understanding that, if you don't provide opportunities to people in the modern world, you could have social unrest.
Right.
So this is a component in China and other places. This is an understanding that this is part of, the aspiration society that most nations are trying to develop. So you'll see certain reactions in those nations, and the severity of what they're doing relates to these larger problems of budget. So in the United States, we haven't talked too much about the United States, obviously, but is what you see here is a kind of a different reaction, partly because, in other parts of the world, there's the Ministry of Education. It's a national structure and funding program. But the United States is very decentralized. So we have a role for the federal government, but we don't have an equivalent to a Ministry of Education. And therefore, you have different kinds of policy reactions and a different storyline, which is more state by state. And, I'm in California, and so I'm very conscious. I mean, we probably have the most severe reaction and budget shortfalls. The scale is huge, comparatively.
Right. And you used to have the most admired system in the country.
Well, as I've written recently, yes, but it's in the U.S. and certain other places of the world, but the U.S. is a story of increasingly of peaks and valleys, is what I'd like to say, is that the strength that you think of and many others in the world do has eroded really significantly. Access rates have declined. High school graduation rates are not competitive with other parts of the world. So there's a story that goes with that. But back to this larger element, so you've got these different storylines that relate to the United States and how it reacts, and it's very much a state story, state-by-state story with the stimulus bill coming in and helping at various points to mitigate cuts. Then, so I've talked about those that are really, financially in trouble, and they're doing various things. They don't cross-the-board cuts. They cut salaries for faculty. They're doing various things. They tend to keep research funding in place, but they're doing other kinds of things. Then if you go, to Brazil or to China or even to the more healthy parts of Europe, Germany, the Netherlands, even there are problems there with their budgets, and they're facing various austerity moves, you get a really different story. And that is that, yes, in some countries, such as the Netherlands, there are marginal cuts, but they're nothing on the scale that we're talking about. And the basic reason is that there is this understanding that the key to their economic development relates to educational attainment rates and other things, but it's a key component. The business community understands it. There's a consensus about this. It's a constant source of discussion and debate in the European Union, for example, something that doesn't really, it marginally exists here, and it's gotten better, I think, under the Obama administration, but it's very marginal here comparatively. Then if you go to Brazil, it's a different storyline. At the depth of the recession, they were, had a 1% GDP growth, not a negative growth, right? And now they're at 8%, and they know their national development is absolutely tied to educational attainment levels. So their investment rates continue. So does, with some exceptions, China. So does, even though there, it's a different storyline in places like Taiwan or Japan, in which the population is either stabilized or shrinking, you have a different storyline. But you don't see the kind of severity that you see in a kind of a grouping of nations that are really facing the depth, the most severe impacts of the Great Recession.
Let's welcome phone calls. We're in Madison today, an unusual place for us to be. I have business to tend to here, so Rhonda is helping me out at the studios in Madison. Our call-in number, thus, is different. It's 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Dave Potraz is answering calls here in Madison, and our email address remains the same. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, it's been a long time since we've done comedy, and you're going to hear some very funny pieces, classic comedy, tomorrow at 10 o'clock. So we hope you'll join us, and we'll all laugh. Today we're not laughing, but there are important, serious topics to discuss. Our guest this hour gives us an interesting perspective on a global perspective on what's happening with higher education all over the world. We're prompted to do this because of what took place in England with the demonstrations, because students there will be paying much more for their college. Our guest is John Douglas. He is a senior research fellow, and he is at the Center for Studies in Higher Education at the University of California, Berkeley. And he's done all kinds of books, The California Idea in American Higher Education, The Conditions for Admission, Access, Equity, and the Social Contract of Public Universities. And he's written a great deal about what's happening with higher education in various countries in the world. It is the key, many, as you heard him just say, to economic development in many countries in the world. How many countries have invested in higher education, even though their economies may not be doing very well, and even though they may not, is there a way to still invest in higher education? Let us go to phone calls, and we'll start with Kurt, who's joining us today from Manitowoc. Hi, Kurt.
I tuned in late to the program, but I myself have been sensing something occurring in our time with education. I was just curious if the guest had a comment on this. Right now, we teach our kids K through 6 and then junior high school and high school, and then 2 years of college and 4 years of college, and we send them out there, and or maybe they can go to a tech school or something. But I was thinking that possibly in the future, education will change dramatically, and we won't really teach so much about past things that have happened. Past history will be more inclined to teach about what we need to happen at the moment, at the time to go forward. I was just curious if your guest thought maybe the whole way we educate people in the future will change at all.
All right, Professor Aubrey Douglas.
Well, that's a tough and difficult question. It's very complex. I don't pretend I know exactly how the structure and teaching of curriculum and all that will change over time. But I would say that things are a little bit more. It's harder to change than you might think. Then the question is about the desirability of change. I think if you look at the way that much of the world is moving in the area of, perhaps I can comment best on higher education, is in fact more towards away from kind of only contemporary kind of ideas of engineering or science as the root of for future development of talent and all that, and you're actually seeing a movement towards trying to create more general education and a broader understanding of history and other things in order to inform and create more talent, more talented people to work in business, to all kinds of things. So this is, it's a complex area. And I should note that, in most parts, we're very familiar with the United States structure, and that structure is, for a bachelor's degree, it's a four-year program. Students enter a university, not necessarily knowing their major, and they find their way through that process. And in most parts of the world, you enter a very specific program in physics, for example, or civil engineering. And in fact, there's a very heavy reliance, if you look at these universities, particularly in developing countries, you know, the curriculum and students are largely lined up in science and engineering programs in these areas. So this is the pattern that you see in terms of degree pattern you see in Europe. And then if you look at Asia or other places. So what they're now doing is saying, you know what, these students are too narrow. They aren't learning broad skills that are useful in future labor markets or to create better citizens or other kinds of things like that, altruistic ideas, but generally more about economic development. And so they're looking for ways to actually model elements of the American general education side. So I'm sorry that was a long answer, but there's a lot of complexity to how institutions develop over time, how much you can change within certain political cultures. And I would say, in fact, it's kind of going this other way of saying, you know, we really need to broadly educate our students and not be too narrow.
Let's go next. Thanks, Kurt, for the call. Let's go to Bruce in Wausau next. Hi, Bruce.
Yes, good morning, Kathleen. Your program is excellent. And, you know, I agree with what you said earlier, that this seems to be so complicated and such of a morass or a swamp that I'm not sure how we can get out of this. But, you know, the professor was saying something about these developing countries, which to me means industrialization. The demand for people that have got high skills is really great. In the countries that have been deindustrialized, the need for educated people is almost, I wouldn't say stagnant, but almost a level line. And the thing I was really curious about, you know, they're talking about the expense of education here in this country. Have you people ever done a study as, like, say, in your household or in a business, where your costs are and where you can make it more efficient so that the product is more attractive so more people buy it? And I'll take my comments off the air, Kathy.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for the call.
Well, let's see. I'll see if I can attack that or answer that. Sorry. I think, you know, the one part about the looking at the budgets and how we're spending money in the higher education sector, A, you do have to disaggregate. There's a real difference between a community college and a major research university like, you know, the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Big differences. So there's a lot of different arrays of institutional types, and they do different kinds of things. I think we have been going through a process very much so in the last 5+ years, depending on the state, of looking at expenses and narrowing costs to, in my mind, to a detrimental level. So there's cost cutting. Let me give you an example. In California, we've had a 20% cut in the state operating budget over the last 2 years, only 2 years. If you go back farther and you look at per student spending, don't forget California's growing in population. We're about 37 million people, and we're projected to grow to 50 million in 2050. You know, even if that's a little off, that's a big number. We're seeing the funding per student is going down, and we're not making up those dollars with tuition increases. That's mitigating and helping, but you're having really significant costs. So if you look at the University of California, for example, we've had about, which is a 10-campus, multi-campus system, we've had about a 40% cut in the state funding. So the net effect has been, believe you me, a real process of paring and cutting down. Now, what I would say is that there is room and places to improve. And it could relate to perhaps more serious revisions as to how people are taught. Are they taught more on online environments and these kinds of things? But the jury is really out as to what kind of cost savings you have. What you really find is the major cuts relate to lowering student-to-faculty ratios. That's your primary place where you can make large cuts, because really higher education, think of higher education as like a high-tech business. It's about very highly trained professional people who are providing services. And, again, there could be some radical changes to how those services are given or whatever, but it's basically very much in line with a high-tech business. And if you look at costs over time, you know, there are different ways of looking, analyzing costs.
What happened as a result of those 40% cuts? What got the axe?
Student-to-faculty ratios have gone up. Course offerings have declined, which is, we're worried that these kinds of, now, I'm not talking about just the University of California, because if you look at the California State University, which is our other large, you know, it's twice the size of the University of California, it's a, our other large provider of BA degrees, you have these broad range of impacts. Like I said, course offerings have declined.
Mm-hmm.
You've got student services have been cut, layoff of employees for, you know, in the last year, the University of California laid off almost 2,000 employees, not hiring new faculty. Of course, the student fee increases. One component's gone up 32% since 2008.
Goodness.
But as I said, these increases, which have various socioeconomic impacts, have not been enough to offset the cuts. They're just a mitigation to the cuts.
Mm-hmm.
So these are, you know, the University of California, I'm sorry, Berkeley, the Berkeley campus over the last couple of years has had about a cut of about $80 million in its operating budget. We've increased class sizes by about 8%. So there's a lot. So there's been a process of paring down in costs. I think, you know, you're kind of getting to a point of marginal, you know, if you make additional cuts, you really start having much more exaggerated impacts on perhaps how many students you take in. And in fact, I didn't mention that the University of California also for the first time decided not to accept students who were deemed UC eligible last year for the first time in, you know, basically our history. That was a much bigger impact at CSU. They basically said we're not going to accept around a total of 40,000 students over a two-year period. One estimate is that perhaps within the public sector, including the community colleges, that over 200,000 students were not given a place or able to get
200,000 students.
Yeah, don't forget how big California is. But
right.
200,000 students.
That's a lot of students.
This is all new. This never before when we had budget problems, we always made sure, you know, we kept to our social contract and bringing students in. I'm hopeful that this is not a paradigm shift, but is a blip. So. These are dramatic numbers, and you have to start wondering, well, how much farther can you cut? Just so you know, again, California is, you know, one of the most, has had the most severe impact from the Great Recession. And, you know, we're looking at another mid-year cut of around $9 billion to the state budget. The state budget, I think, is a total of about $88 billion, to just give you a sense of scale.
Mm-hmm.
So how is that going to play out on higher ed is an open question.
Let's go to more phone calls. We go next to Matt is joining us from Appleton. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how are you doing, Kathleen?
All right, Matt.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
See, you know, John, I think you touched on it a little bit earlier as far as comparing the college to a company. And I'm pretty far out there, okay? I'm gonna throw something out there that I hope you can comment on. But I'm looking at why is our government so involved in our college education system in the United States? We allow these corporations to hire lobbyists to go and talk to Congress and Senate to bribe them, or I'm sorry, to lobby them into getting something voted in. You know what? Seriously, I think the corporations should be involved in funding the colleges and let them write it off and get them out of the Congress and Senate. Get them out of there. Put corporate, they're the ones who are going to benefit the most from the college education population.
All right, Professor Aubrey
Douglas. They have no responsibility towards this. They lean on our government for the government to provide the education for their corporations, and yet they have no. They're not giving anything towards it.
All right. Professor Aubrey Douglas.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting perspective, absolutely. And you're right. You know, if I think in the 1950s, for example, corporations were big lobbyists to expand higher education access because they needed engineers, and it was, you know, a better system to have them trained in our public universities or other places. to meet their labor needs. So there's a long history of that relationship. But I think, you know, you're not going to be able to make any kind of a paradigm shift. Corporations could argue that they do already subsidize higher education through taxes, of course. They do provide, we are seeing increased incentives in activity by corporations to provide, you know, those that have interests in universities in providing buildings, for example, very common. So there are those links already. The one question I think is more relevant is, well, where is the business community, particularly those that benefit directly through the labor that's provided or the research? You know, these links are quite significant, and in my view, generally very positive. But where is that community in helping to lobby at the state level? I think you conflate it a little bit. You know, what's the role of the federal government versus the states? The federal government is basically does two things for higher education generally. It provides financial aid, particularly for low-income students, and it provides funding for basic research. The action and where the future of public higher education goes is at the state level, largely. I think there should be a larger role for the federal government, but that's another discussion. So I think the valid piece here is, well, where is the business community in lobbying at the state level in trying to make sure that we don't have further cuts or larger cuts down the road for higher ed? How does it fit into a larger plan for socioeconomic mobility and the labor needs of the nation?
Can you take us abroad again for just a few moments? Because I'm still trying to get a handle on those countries that are doing well. What about Japan? We hear that Asian countries are doing much better in terms of educating scientists and people and engineers, people for the jobs that are around right now and that pay pretty decently. Do they have a whole different system there? And their economy, of course, is much better than ours as well. But there's something fundamentally different, I think, that's happening in some of those Asian countries.
Yeah, now Japan is a little different than the rest of the landscape because it is, you know, an earlier, you know, developer of its economy, thanks large part to the post-World War II period under the U.S. So Japan has its own unique kind of set of problems. If, you know, they have not weathered the Great Recession as well as other parts of Asia. They've also had a very, as your listeners are probably aware of, a very elongated kind of economic malaise that began in the 90s with, you know, certain exceptions in certain industries, such as the car industry. So Japan has a different set of things going on. And, in fact, they're in a process of trying to work, and they were before the Great Recession, of how to reform their higher ed system, reorganize it. And the reason is that they face basically population stagnation and actually decline. So they have developed a series of private institutions in public, and they're looking for ways to merge those institutions and try to create more quality out of that. So they are also trying to recruit international students because they do have some of the most mature universities like the University of Tokyo. So their storyline is, how can we reorganize our system, reduce capacity to some degree, try to bring in new students, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Now, if you go to Taiwan or China or Korea, you know, very different stories lines there. Economic development and growth is robust. They're looking to, you know, expand educational access. There are some, I should say, though, there are some, Taiwan, for example, has stagnant population, so there is a different dynamic there. But they're not making cuts. They're investing or thinking of other ways to enhance the quality of their institutions. Just so people understand, Korea, for example, has the highest higher education attainment rates of any country.
Really?
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
It's a frenzy, and we could debate the why, if this is good or bad. But it's like a culture in much of Asia, and Korea is a great symbol of this, that sees almost fanatically education as the key for individual or families to, you know, be more established in society. It's a status thing, but it's also about salaries and all of that kind of thing. So there's this drive that is just really significant. And the net result is that the nation state has tried to develop and meet some of that, but you have a huge for-profit sector that has come in. So although they have the highest attainment rates, the one question is, well, what's the quality of those institutions? So much of Asia is beginning to turn to this question more and more. How can we improve the quality? But they generally have more resources to spend on that kind of activity.
Let's welcome more phone calls. We have many people online. This is an important issue for many of our listeners, of course. Well, it's an important issue all over the world. Our guest this hour is Professor John Aubrey Douglas. He is at the Center for Studies in Higher Education at UC Berkeley and knows a great deal about higher education, why it is people are marching in the streets in England, how various countries in the world have dealt with higher education, retraining workers, making college affordable for people, even though times have been pretty rough for a lot of countries. So to you, with more calls momentarily, our number, we're in Madison today. The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. The email address, we haven't had any emails. Well, give me an email. If it's good, we'll put it on the air. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I want to remind you that tomorrow during this time period, it's our comedy show. We've been doing these for several years now, ever since I heard Dustin Hoffman on Talk of the Nation, and he was talking about his career and how Mike Nichols gave him a big break when he cast him in The Graduate, and how we all ought to listen to Mike Nichols and Elaine May because he had learned so much about timing and comedy technique as a result of listening to their CDs. So he said you should all go buy a copy of their comedy routines. And I followed his advice. It was one of those radio moments where I stopped the car and I went to a store and got Mike Nichols and Elaine May and just found them to be brilliant comedians with indeed an exquisite sense of timing. And so we thought, well, let's do comedy. And that was years ago, and we've done comedy shows periodically ever since then. So we'll have mostly classic comedy. I guarantee you, you'll find it really, some of it is just hysterical. Johnny Carson has a piece on a wake or a funeral for a guy who wrote the thesaurus. You know where that's going. Very funny piece from Mike Nichols and Elaine May, kind of esoteric. Woody Allen, a hysterical piece. A very, very funny piece on the American anthem and what it should be. Well, there are lots of pieces, and you're going to just have a rip-roaring great time, as we say, tragedy tomorrow, comedy tonight. I've been singing that song all the time since I remembered that song. So, fun tomorrow. First hour, we'll be speaking with a farmer from Iowa who wrote a really important piece in the New York Times some time ago, and we're going to look at farming. Let's go next to Jennifer from Madison. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to talk about something on a very local level, and then maybe your guest could broaden it out to a global level. We just elected, our governor-elect did not finish college, and he is going to be, one of his mandates is going to be to manage the public education system in Wisconsin. And I think, you know, based on some of his policies in Milwaukee County, he doesn't want, in my mind, you know, everyone has a different idea of what the social contract entails. And for me, a public education and access to a publication is a fundamental part of that. And I question his commitment to that. And I wonder why, as a state, we elected him.
You know, well, you think it makes
and what and what that says about us in terms of our you know, belief in education. I come from a working class background. I have a master's degree. I have siblings who didn't finish high school. And I absolutely needed federal programs, Pell Grants, and all those sorts of things to be able to have access to the education that I got. And so that's one huge concern on a local level. And I guess what
Jennifer, before you go on with that, don't you think, though, that he understands the importance of higher education? He's got two children. My dad never made it past high school, and he knew how important higher education was. Just because you didn't finish college or didn't go to college doesn't mean that you can't be highly interested and committed to higher education, don't you think?
I don't question his intellect or anything like that. I'm not saying that just because he didn't finish college that he can't make appropriate decisions. But I'm saying that his policies in terms of what the social contract allows for and what the priorities are, like the fact that he basically turned back the light rail program speaks to me to a lack of sort of commitment to educated, work. The understanding that, open for business means that you need a certain type of workforce to be able to facilitate a business climate, and that public education and the ability to access to opportunity is sort of fundamental. And I guess with his, downsize everything and we're just going to leave it to the private sector mentality, I don't know if he's committed to public education. I mean, the institution he attended was private college, and or a university. I'm not, again, suggesting that if you don't finish college, you can't run the state. What I'm saying is, does that reflect his approach to the importance of it?
And I don't expect you to be familiar with the intricacies of Professor Aubrey Douglas, but let me just reframe the question in a way. Do you think that... how can I reframe it? It's not an issue, do you think? You've mentioned what's happened in California, too. I mean, can we say that there is one political party that's better on these higher education issues than another political party? Does it make a difference if you've been to college yourself and what kind of institution you've gone to as to how you will lead a state?
Well, I would say that perhaps marginally Democrats are more robust and strong in supporting public higher education. I would say that. But, the storylines vary depending whether you're in Washington or perhaps in Wisconsin, and if you're a local school district in San Diego, so there's different things going on. What I would say is that kind of at the macro level, what we're seeing is many of these states, including Wisconsin, are facing large-scale budget
problems. Yes.
So these are relating to these macro issues of, well, how much are we taxing and what are we spending our money on and what's the short-term and long-term impact of the Great Recession. But this is coloring actions in the U.S. significantly. And again, as I said, you could see certain similarities with Ireland or other financially challenged nation states. So, I know Wisconsin is facing a 12.8% or something like that projected funding gap. So this is bleeding down to, directly affects how states are looking at higher ed. There's a very strong, political movement in the United States that relates to the concept of shrinking government and not raising taxes. So this all fits into this kind of element that basically makes public education increasingly lower on the priority list, understanding there's other competing needs, Medicare, all this stuff that's going on. So that bleeds down, and there's a very strong, political movement here it sounds to me that is it the superintendent of public instruction, or what's the title of the person that your caller referred to?
The governor.
Oh, the governor. I'm sorry. I missed it. I know you
governor
have a
elect.
Governor, but I'm, yes, and who has... So he fits a very, typical, it sounds from what I've read, and a very typical kind of set of priorities that relate to that, that agenda. What I will say is this, the United States really does need to improve educational attainment levels. You referred earlier to how great the California system is and stuff. In many ways.
How great it was, said.
How great it was or is. It really is, again, a kind of a past tense discussion. Compared to economic competitors out there, the United States is no longer number one in educational attainment rates, and you can do this in various ways. How many people are 18 to 22 that are going to college, or how many are getting out of high school, or test scores. There's these international test scores on math and science. But again, it's a those are averages, so it's a story of peaks and valleys. And we keep what we're getting is more and more of that peak and valley story, and that is the peaks are, you know, are Madison, University of Wisconsin-Madison, high class, very productive institution. And the valleys are, you know, people can't get into basic education or get their educational their education that they need in order to be competitive in the economy.
Yeah.
So so this final point I want to make is that what you're seeing, even though there's been some backlash now at the federal level on this, is what I call the Brazilian effect. And that is that as public education at the higher ed level, which, you know, I'm more familiar with, can't keep up with demand or needs in society, we're seeing a much faster growth of the for-profits. And mm-hmm. the for-profits are coming in
mm-hmm.
because the financial structure that we have in the U.S. is huge subsidies to for-profits. They're not operating in a free market. It's not a free market. They're tapping into taxpayer money. So if you've heard of the University of Phoenix, the largest
for-profit
in the world, 80% of their operating budget comes from the federal government. Okay, that's the students who are getting loans. So the other part of that is there is quality in the for-profit sector. There is, but there's a lot of really low quality
mm-hmm.
and a lot of scams and things going on. And so what you're seeing is a large amount of taxpayer money, your money, going and funneling to for-profits that are benefiting because the publics can't keep up with demand.
Mm-hmm.
And but you're having really high attrition rates. They, you know, are very, there's, you know, one studies that maybe 14% of students in certain sectors of the for-profit actually ever get a degree. You know, this is an ongoing debate because it's really hard to get good data from the for-profits, the private sector operators.
Yeah.
As I said, there's a role for them. They have quality. But what you have is this is the providers that are coming up to take the place of the public sector that can't keep up with
right.
demand or quality.
And for me, I just...
That's not a good thing. And the final thing is, why do I call it the Brazilian effect? Because that's what you see in developing economies.
Yeah. And in terms of what's happening in Wisconsin, I can't believe that any governor, governor-elect, I don't care what your political party, can't realize the import. They all realize the importance of the University of Wisconsin system. It is a vital part of our state, and I'm
sure they
will do
more money. Than
well, of course. And one of the chancellor, I wish we could channel Governor Lee Dreyfus, who was a Republican, who was chancellor at Stevens Point, and extolled higher education and spoke of it and had a great gift of gab more than anybody. And so, at any rate. We'll see what happens. Do we have time for one more phone call, probably? Habu from Madison. Hi.
Good morning, and thank you.
You're welcome.
Just a very quick point. You know, I'm somewhat distressed when I hear the kind of arguments that have been advanced by your guests. To be sure, I am for higher education.
Well, good. We all are.
But this is the problem, and especially with people in the public sector. The public sector really feeds off, and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, the private sector doing well, meaning people have jobs, they pay taxes, and then that sustains the public sector, which is, in a way, a service sector to the public sector, which is a service sector, which provides services to the private sector, like regulating and education and all this. But when we have people in the academy who said very loudly, and this is no reason to target that. You know, we've got to offshore jobs while people would move up the food chain, which was so incredulous. And then now they want to keep their cushy jobs you know, have the people who are unemployed and who are barely making it, working three jobs, sustain the public sector. I find that to be a bifurcation of what's happening in the
society.
All
right, Habu, we're short on time. Professor Aubrey Douglas.
Well, you know, believe you me, the public sector, the private sector, excuse me, is absolutely vital and is what supports higher education. Absolutely. I don't mean to come off saying that there's some other kind of relationship. It's when you get down to it, though, if you look at the research universities, it's kind of a mutual relationship. There is a relationship to how well the public sector in higher education, for example, has done over time and economic development. And there are many, many interesting studies, Paul Romer, various, just a wide array of Gary Becker about this relationship. But I don't want to come across as saying that I don't care about the private sector, or that somehow we just leech off it and, you know, and the public higher ed functions independently. Absolutely not. It's a symbiotic kind of relationship, and the health of the private sector is absolutely fundamental to all government services.
Okay. Professor Aubrey Douglas, thank you so much for being with us this hour. Thanks for your international perspective.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Our guest, Professor John Aubrey Douglas, he is a senior research fellow in the Center for Studies in Higher Education at the University of California, Berkeley. He caught our attention because of what happened in England with students demonstrating. We did, too. I should have known this, but the educational background of Governor-elect Scott Walker is that he did attend Marquette University for 3.5 years. He left during his senior year, so he's only a half year away. He can pick up the credits here in Madison and finish the degree and stop with all the controversy about it, huh? That's all that needs to happen. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for guiding me through our hours here in Madison. Thanks to Dave Potraz for doing on-air production. A reminder that tomorrow we're going to talk about farming for the first hour of the program with a very he's a great writer, a farmer from Iowa. And tomorrow at 10, comedy! A whole hour of comedy! It'll be fun. Larry Mueller is with you next.